In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about what we know about human history and what some of our ancient human ancestors looked like and how they lived their lives. One of them in particular, individual known as Homo erectus, or perhaps you might also know him by his name of Peking Man. The fossils, the name given to some fossils that were found in 1927 in China. We'll be talking this morning in this hour of the show with Russell Sheehan. He's professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa, and he is the co-author of a recently published book titled Dragon Bone Hill, and that is the name of the place where these fossils were found in China. The subtitle is An Ice Age Saga of Homo Erectus. It is published by the Oxford University Press. And as we talk in this hour of the show, your questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Sheehan, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing very well.
Good. I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Perhaps before talking specifically about Homo erectus and about Peking Man, maybe you, to establish some sort of context or picture in people's minds about where this individual fits in to what we now think we know about what the human family tree looks like. If you start where we are, we're Homo sapiens, and since we named ourselves, something like smart man or thinking man. I guess you, if you name yourself, you can do something like that. So if you go back from where we are, take steps back, at what point do you get to Homo erectus, and how does this individual fit in with the other fossils that so far we found?
Well, Homo erectus plays a very pivotal role in human evolution. It is the species that comes right before modern Homo sapiens. Some people argue there may be another little step in there, which is named Homo heidelbergensis, but that species may or may not be in reality. So the easiest way to think of Homo erectus is it is a hominid that evolved in Africa about 2 million years ago, and then spread out across the globe at about 1.9 million years, and became fixed in populations in Java and in China. And later on, modern Homo sapiens, which also evolved in Africa, spread out and replaced all of the Homo erectus populations around. But if we go to Africa, we find that the ancestor of Homo sapiens is something that we call Homo erectus.
Mm-hmm. You use the word hominid.
Yes, hominid is the general term for the family of humans. So in a sense, I will probably use that, or you can sort of make it interchangeable with human, but basically it is, you know, using the old Linnaean taxonomy, you know, the way we characterize everything has a genus name and a species name. If we group all of the species that are upright and that are in our family, we can take that, you know, in a sense we define it back to almost 5 million years ago and all the way up, of course, to modern Homo sapiens. So that includes everything, like all the forms called Australopithecus that live in Africa, and, of course, all the Homo erectus fossils, various places, and, of course, modern Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm. But again, just to underscore what you said, the important thing about Homo erectus is that here is a turning point where we say what came before was somehow different, and what comes after it eventually is us.
Exactly.
Hmm. Talk a little bit about a Dragon Bone Hill, about the site.
Okay, the site of Dragon Bone Hill it's about 30 miles southwest of Beijing, which is the capital of China, and it is a site that was actually known to Chinese peasants and dragon bone collectors for thousands of years. It is an area of, like I say, about 30 miles or so from Beijing, and it's a collapsed cave deposit that was occupied by many animals over a number of years. Early Chinese often went there to mine the cave for bone, because they use bone in traditional Chinese medicine. Even to this day, fossil bone is used in traditional Chinese medicine, and the Chinese call that bone dragon bones. Mm-hmm. But it was in the 1920s that Dragon Bone Hill first came to the awareness of paleoanthropologists and the public all around the world, because it was in the 20s that the first Western scientists went in there working with some Chinese scientists, and they began to collect fossils from there. Mm-hmm. At first, they only found isolated teeth of these early humans, but later they eventually found, relatively complete skulls and a few limb bones scattered throughout the cave.
So the reason that they considered that they went there at all was just because it was known to be a place where there were fossil bones, and,
exactly.
And someone just thought, well, this is a good place to look, just to see what sort of interesting things we might find.
Right, and we don't know when they first started mining, maybe 2,000 years ago, because this practice of using dragon bones for medicinal purposes goes way back in Chinese history. But in any case, you know, the Westerners, they became aware of the site because, I guess, through the Chinese network, it was passed down that there was bone at this site.
Mm-hmm. The very first thing that was found was a tooth, just one tooth?
Well, there was actually a couple teeth found very early on, but they were not excavated. The first single tooth to be excavated, you know, was in the early 20s, and that was the tooth that later became the namesake, in a sense, the type specimen, we call it, for of Homo erectus. It was originally called Sinanthropus pekingensis. And that was the name it was given, which means Chinese ape man of Beijing. But later on, it became known as Homo erectus, once we sorted out, you know, that we don't need all these names to describe things.
Hmm. One of the things that I'm sure that, you know, non-anthropologists puzzle over is that when you find something, particularly if you're finding fragments, I guess if you find a tooth, probably most people would look at that and know what that was. But if
Right.
you're finding bone fragments, if they're pieces, how do you even know what it is that you're looking at, that it is a piece of a bone and not just a rock? Or is it that obvious?
Oh, I think it is quite obvious. First of all, fossilized bone really is, composition-wise, a rock. And in a sense, what happens during the process of fossilization, all of the organic remains in a bone or tooth or skull fragment, in a sense, they're all sort of leached out by the geological process of being buried, and they're replaced by minerals. So if a bone is completely fossilized, it has the composition of the rocks around it. However, it retains its anatomical shape. And of course, one of the things that paleoanthropologists do, like myself and my students who I'm training, we become experts in identifying every part of the modern human skeleton, and of course all the modern ape skeletons, fossil apes, and so we get very good at finding a little tiny fragment and knowing where it fits in. Mm-hmm. And basically, the skeleton of Homo erectus is very similar to the skeleton of modern Homo sapiens. So if you're a good anatomist, you can pick up any bone of a modern human. Let's say I have anatomy classes, study boxes of bones. You can just go into the box, pick a bone out, and you can tell exactly what it is. The same sort of analogy we can use when these early excavators were digging the site of Dragon Bone Hill. They would find pieces of bone, oftentimes very fragmented, but they could still identify what part of the skeleton they came from.
How they, though, at that time, did they decide that this bone might be hundreds of thousands of years old rather than just maybe a couple of hundred years old, or maybe even 1,000 years old?
Okay, that's a good question. And remember I talked about the process of fossilization, in a sense, for when a bone starts out as organic. Well, first it starts out inside a living organism. Then that organism dies, maybe gets eaten, or dragged into the cave. Who knows how it got there? There's a lot of ways we can explain that. But then those bones, in a sense, all the tissue rots away, and you're just left with the bone. And then that bone gets covered up. And through the process of fossilization, those minerals change. And in a sense, we can actually see it's a fossil. So that process of fossilization can take, 50,000 years. So the early researchers, since these things were fully fossilized, they suspected they were old. But the way they dated the site the first time, back in the 20s, was by all those species that were non-human species that were in the site. Basically, what I mean by that is all the carnivores, all the ungulates, those are like antelope or deer, all those species that were in the site with the Homo erectus fossils, they could look at those and see that they were, some were extinct species. So they knew they had to go back into the Pleistocene, the Ice Age. And more recently now, though, we've been come up with various dating techniques where we can actually date certain parts of the cave site, not the fossils themselves. We can date the sediments in which the fossils occur. And by using those techniques and something called paleomagnetism, looking at the flip-flop and the magnetic fields of the Earth, we can say today that this site is about 410,000 years old to 670,000 years old. And the early researchers, they had an idea it was in that same ballpark. But they didn't have a way to date things. So they said it was Middle Pleistocene. Hmm. And today it is indeed Middle Pleistocene, which means it comes from the middle part of the Ice Age.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Russell Sheehan, is professor of anthropology at University of Iowa, and he is the co-author, along with Noel Boaz, of the book Dragon Bone Hill that came out earlier this spring. The subtitle is An Ice Age Saga of Homo Erectus, and it's published by Oxford University Press, and does indeed tell the story of the find of these fossils that came to be called Peking Man, and something of now what anthropologists think about what these individuals were like and how they lived and something of how they behaved and how it is that they fit into the bigger picture of human evolution. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We talked earlier about the fact that the fossil remains that were found were in pieces and had to be reconstructed, and some of the pieces that were missing had to actually be supplied so that you could get an intact skull, for example, or a whole skull, so that you could then go from there and draw more conclusions about what these individuals were like. This is sort of your layperson's question. How difficult is it, if you just have a handful of pieces, to then get them together and then to go from there to fill in what you don't have?
Well, yeah, that's pretty easy to answer. When you find this pile of bones, let's say when you're excavating and you find a pile of skull bones, in other words, broken parts of the skull, what you do is it's just like a jigsaw puzzle, exactly. In a jigsaw puzzle, you lay out all the pieces and you look at the colors and you sort of figure out what shapes go with what. Well, the same thing we do by putting back together a fossil skull. We essentially first look at what kinds of pieces of bone we have. And we can identify the front part, which we call the frontal, from the back part, which we call the occipital part of the skull. So we can easily come up and do that. Then we take some glue and we try to glue back together all those parts where they broke along a crack. So we, in a sense, we're putting them back together. And so we end up with usually four or five pieces that each may consist of 10 individual bone fragments all glued back together. And then we try to put those back together on a skull frame. And again, if we find areas where the bones conjoin, you might be able to get the whole side of one part of the skull. And since we know the skull is bilateral, in other words, one side of our skull looks like the other side, you can go over to the other side and add in just plaster where that sort of is equivalent to the actual conjoined pieces on the other side. And so by that process, we can put together an entire cranium. The problem is, it's not always so easy if you don't have conjoined pieces. So this is where there's a certain art in paleoanthropology. And most scientists would rather not, reconstruct something unless they have enough evidence to show how it fit together.
When they found these remains and that they were, and essentially they were all in pieces,
right?
How did they think at all, ask this question, why is it that all we're doing is finding pieces and not and at least bigger pieces, or perhaps whole pieces, whole skulls, for example.
Right. Well, I think this is the crux of a major issue about the discovery of Peking Man. The early researchers, when they excavated, every skull was broken up into maybe anywhere from 6 to 20 pieces or more. None of the skulls were complete. And they only found very few limb bones. And all those limb bones were cracked open, or in some cases, like a spiral fracture, like twisted, and where they crack in a certain way. And no one really hypothesized how they got that way. In our book, Dragon Bone Hill, we came up with a hypothesis that what we're actually dealing with at Dragon Bone Hill, at this famous site, is not the cave home of Peking Man. Rather, it is the lair of giant hyenas called Pachycrocuta. These giant hyenas roamed all of Asia. At that time, they were lion-sized, much bigger than any modern-day hyena. And we think that the hominids, the human ancestors that are in that cave, were brought into the cave or dragged into the cave, perhaps kicking and screaming, and then later on crushed up. And one of the things that hyenas love the most is the lipid-rich brain. There's a lot of protein and a lot of fat in the brain. And so what they want to do, they go ahead and they crack open the skull. And in the process of cracking open the skull, they expose the brain and they eat the brain. And, of course, all those pieces that occurred from biting the skull in several different places are what we find went during the excavation.
Hmm. How did earlier the people who found these, how did they think about that particular issue, and why did it sort of take so long before you came along and said, well, what we really think is happening is that animals attacked and ate the Homo erectus, and it wasn't anything else, it wasn't warfare, it wasn't they were eating each other, it wasn't anything like that?
I think that the easy answer to that is, if you look back, you have to ask the question, when were these fossils found? From the 1920s to about 1937. Then World War II happened, or at least the beginnings of World War II happened in China. The Japanese had invaded, and work at Dragon Bone Hill stopped. And, of course, all the publications that resulted from that research came out, you know, throughout the 30s and into the early 40s. And then they also stopped because no one could work there. At that time, we didn't have our sophisticated view of what cave faunas, you know, in a sense, the assemblage of mammals and humans in a cave site, you know, how to interpret those. We, in a sense, you know, in all those intervening years, more and more study has been done on the process of how bone gets into caves and, in a sense, how we can explain the diversity of species in a cave. And so there had been nothing done. This was one of the first cave sites ever done. In fact, this cave site has more sediment removed than any site that was ever excavated before or after it. So it was a huge excavation. But that modern-day, late 20th century, 21st century view of how to interpret those bones was lacking. Mm-hmm. So the researchers interpreted them as, this was the cave home of Peking Man, that they had built fires in the cave and they killed animals and dragged them in, sort of the romantic view of how we see our early ancestors. But we don't think Homo erectus was like that at all. We think Homo erectus was a scavenger. It was also the prey of this giant hyena. It may have scavenged meat off of the bones that hyenas had killed, maybe using fire to chase them away. But it certainly did not live in this cave. There's only 51 individuals, partial pieces of 51 individuals found in the site. Yet, if we look at what other species are found in the cave, more than 3,000 fossil bones of hyenas have been found, including 3 complete skeletons have been found of this giant hyena. They were the ones that were living in the cave. And, in a sense, they're the primary owners of the cave. And hominids got in there once in a while, maybe to scavenge things from them, or maybe when they were out of the cave. but they weren't living in there day in, day out.
Hmm. Well, another one of the things that you you address in the book, and you're not the first, obviously, to talk about this, but was one of the great mysteries associated with Peking Man, and that is what happened to the original fossils. When the Japanese, it looked like the Japanese were going to invade China, they tried to gather the stuff together and get it out of China and to the United States. They disappeared. No one apparently knows exactly what happened. Some people over the years have entertained theories that, well, maybe they're still in China someplace or in the United States someplace or they're buried someplace. I think you are among those who argue that chances are they probably were just tossed aside. They were picked up and they did what Chinese did with other fossil bones they had. They ground them up and they used them as medicine.
Yes, the story is kind of quite an involved story. We spend, I think, two chapters in the book, two long chapters explaining all the events. We found a bunch of new documents from the Rockefeller Foundation and a couple of other places that had not yet been consulted. So we were able to put a new spin on this. This story's been retold many times and in a number of popular books. A couple of just in a nutshell, I can sort of summarize it.
Mm-hmm.
Excavation stopped in 1937. And as I said, and the fossils were all kept in the Peking Union Medical School. And so that allowed researchers to still go in and study the fossils. One of the principal Western scientists working on these was named Franz Weidenreich. And he actually spent quite a bit of time studying those, and they also made wonderful molds of all the specimens. So we have very exact cast today of what was found. But anyway, as the war heated up in China, even Weidenreich decided to leave. He stayed on from 1937 all the way up until I think early 1941, and then he himself went back to the U.S. And he arranged before he left to have the fossils shipped out. At first, they decided they were going to keep them there, but as things got hotter and hotter, they decided it was better to move them out. So the fossils were packed up into crates. They were loaded into a truck. They made a short trip to the American embassy, I think, and then they were taken by Marines to the train station in Beijing. They were put on a train headed to the east toward the port city of Tianjin, and then on Tianjin they were supposed to be loaded onto a ship and eventually get back to the States. And there they were going to be kept for safekeeping and, of course, later returned to China when all this conflict was over. We know they were loaded on the train. We have records of that. We know the day they were loaded on the train is a very fateful day in American history. That was December 7th, 1941. So the day the fossils were actually moving toward Tianjin is the day that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and at the same time, the Japanese mounted a very big invasion of China, of this whole part of northern China. So in that chaos of the beginning of World War II, we don't know. The train, there's no record of the boxes actually arriving in Tianjin. And what we propose in the book is that the train was delayed, maybe in a sense stopped, and that all the cargo was searched and things that were not of economic value were simply tossed off the train. Maybe the train was commandeered to be used for the Japanese war effort. And of course, we think that these trunks that held all of the fossils were just tossed off the train. And of course, if that was the case, certainly local Chinese, once the train moved away, they probably went through all the stuff. They found all these fossils and thinking, oh boy, here's some more dragon bones already neatly packed.
Mm.
And we think that they may have been sold and eventually ground up for medicinal purposes.
Mm. So we have, even though the original fossils were lost, we have the casts that still anthropologists ever since, I'm sure, have been looking at.
Yes, and they're very good casts, so we can actually do quite a bit of work with them.
But then also, I believe that after the war, new Homo erectus, new Peking Man fossils were found.
Right. Once in the mid 50s, the Chinese started work at Jokotan, and it continued into throughout the 60s, and they did find parts of another skull and some more teeth and I think a few limb bones and a lot more artifacts. So they found all of that stuff. So those originals, all that material is in the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology, which we nicknamed the IVPP, and that is the main research sort of paleoanthropological and paleontological institute for all of China. And the Homo erectus fossils they found are housed in this museum, or in the museum part of this institute.
We are just a bit past the midpoint. We have a caller we will get right to. I'd like to introduce again the guest, Russell Sheehan.
It's actually Shahan.
Oh, Shahan. My apologies.
Yeah, I should have mentioned it earlier.
I wasn't really sure. That's the pronunciation that I got. And
right. It's impossible to know how to say it by looking at it.
It's one of those names, yes. If you don't know, there's no hope. Shahan. Very good. I try to, as someone who has gone through life having my name mispronounced, I try, if I can, to get people's names right.
All right.
Russell Sheehan, he's professor of anthropology at University of Iowa. The book, which he co-authored, is titled Dragon Bone Hill. By the way, there is a website for the book if you're interested in looking at that, and you can see some reviews and some articles that discuss some of the same material that's in the book. And for that, you can go to www.uiowa.edu/dragon, and you will find it, and you can take a look at it. And, of course, the book came out earlier this spring, and it is, I'm sure it's in the bookstore if you want to go out and take a look at it that way. We have a caller here in Champaign-Urbana, and it's line number one.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Interesting, but please comment on, like, when and where people first settled at Dragon Hill or where they came from. The National Geographic had an article on everyone's from the Rift Valley, essentially, and they tried to describe this by DNA studies. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, Homo erectus evolved in Africa about 2 million years ago. It spread out in across Asia. The first place we find Homo erectus in Asia is in Java, on the island of Java, and those are dated to around 1.8 million years ago. We don't know exactly when these same humans got into China, but we do have records at about a million years or so ago of Homo erectus living in China. Remember, China is more north, and it's a much more temperate climate, and of course, during parts of the Ice Age, it was very cold. So the actual humans that are at Dragon Bone Hill date between 670 and 410,000 years ago. It was during that period of time that there were a number of warm oscillations in climate. In other words, the climate became much warmer. And it's during that time we think Homo erectus that was living in China, southern China, moved up to the north and inhabited this area. And it was likely that there even are some cold spikes during even that 410 to 670,000 year period. And we think those same humans may have moved south again when it became too cold in the north. So basically, we could say the source for Homo erectus at Dragon Bone Hill came from Homo erectus living in other parts of China. And it was only when the climate warmed up enough that it could actually move up into this more and exploit this area, which, of course, the game moved. When the climate warmed, the game moved. Homo erectus followed those same species and eventually found their way to Dragon Bone Hill.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you might be listening, around Illinois or Indiana. Also, if you would be listening to us on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. One of the things that I'm sure that you get to once you have collected fossils and you've tried to reassemble them and put them together and get the best kind of picture of the individuals you can, then you start looking at what you've got and start thinking about what can we tell about them and perhaps about their behavior, about how they lived based on this. And you talked about the fact that the skeleton of the Homo erectus was pretty much like ours. The singular difference, and it's one of the stories that you write about in the book, is when you look at what they look like from the neck up. Particularly the thing that you focused on was the fact that they have a very thick skull I think you described it in the book as looking at something like a bicycle helmet, and I'd say that's a pretty good description. What did you go on there to speculate based on the fact that these individuals had this very, very heavy skull?
From the head up, if we look at Homo erectus, we really see dramatic differences when we compare them to modern humans. The brain of Homo erectus was only one-third to one-quarter less than modern humans. So basically, a Homo erectus brain was about two-thirds the size of a modern human, or maybe up to three-quarters. So it had a significantly smaller brain. But the whole skull architecture has been rearranged. If you look at it in profile, you'll see that the skull is flattened. They didn't have any forehead. And where the forehead exists in our own cells, Homo erectus had this bony ridge. It was called a torus above the eyes. We call it a supraorbital, which means above the orbits, torus. And that torus, this thickening of bone, gave it sort of a beetle-browed view. If we look at it from front, they would have had enormous brow ridges there. And those brow ridges, if you rub your own skull right above your eye socket, you can sort of feel a very tiny ridge. But Homo erectus had this ridge that really projected out. And then, of course, as I said, no forehead. So in a sense, their skull above the brow ridge, it sloped back very abruptly. And then it sort of rounded up to the top of the skull. And then on the back side of the skull, we found another very thickened ridge of bone. And that ridge of bone extends around the back part. So the skull is very thick all the way along. The skull, the actual thickness of the cranium, the bone that separates the brain from the outside was thick all the way around, significantly thicker than modern humans, maybe as much as three times. And we have these big bony prominences sticking out the front and the rear, which form sort of a ring of bone around the entire skull. We think this particular anatomy evolved as protection against interpersonal violence. In other words, within Homo erectus. It didn't evolve to protect it from hyena eating, because hyenas could easily crush through, and of course they did crush through this cranium, even though it was very thick. But we think maybe Homo erectus was practicing some sort of interpersonal violence, and there was, in a sense, maybe they were hitting each other with some object. And because we also find on a lot of the skulls of Homo erectus from the site that were excavated, we find these with what's something we call a healed depressed fracture. In a sense, what it means is a slight depression in the bone of the skull, where the only way to explain it is if some heavy object hit the skull. And those healed depressed fractures are a dead giveaway for some kind of interpersonal violence. We find those same healed depressed fractures in some modern humans that also practice headbanging and as a form of, social interaction.
Hmm. So your speculation is that, and it's not unreasonable, I guess, when you see that other male animals engage in this kind of behavior in competing over mates, that you think that maybe, and again, it's speculation, but not unreasonable that's what this is about.
Yeah, well, it's one explanation that we think this other, and there really aren't any other good explanations. But of course, this doesn't make ours right just because no one else can explain it. Mm-hmm. It makes ours, a competing hypothesis. But, unless we can go back into time, it's going to be hard to figure out this. One of the things we're doing, we're doing tests on modern human crania, to testing them. These are cadavers that were used in medical school, testing the thickness of the bone and how much force can be applied to it before it fractures. So we're going to do some empirical tests on modern human skulls, and then later on we'll try to apply that data to analyzing these fossil human skulls from Dragon Bone Hill.
Mm-hmm. Given the fact that, as we were discussing, as you explained, that if you look at the rest of the skeleton of these individuals, it's not that much different than ours, and that the big difference, the feature that really gets your attention is the head. I don't suppose anybody has made any kind of reasoned argument that, in fact, the heads and the rest of the skeletons don't go together.
No, because we actually have some individuals, like from Africa, where we find the skull and the postcranial, skeleton together.
There's no question.
There's no question. And besides, there's only one early human in the site at Dragon Bone Hill. We just find one kind. And obviously the limb bones we find, and there's not many of those. There's a couple of thigh bones, partial thigh bones, and there's a bit of the upper arm skeleton in one case, and so on. But those bones that we find, you know, would match very well for the skeleton of Homo erectus. So I think there's no way to sort of say that the skulls didn't go with the skeletons.
Mm. And as far as the significance of the shape of the skull and its very thickness and so forth, this is something that just begs explanation. You can't just say, well, it doesn't really mean anything.
Well, no. I mean, one hypothesis is it evolved for some other reason that we just don't know. But we wanted to explain it. Remember, we wrote a book about this. We didn't want to just say, oh, well, it has a weird skull, and, you know, we don't really know why it has one. So we came up with this hypothesis. And you know, these kinds of hypotheses, though, are eminently untestable because we can't really go back into time and see what they were doing. So basically, it's one of those ideas that's out there that my colleagues will discuss, probably teach about in class, you know, in their very classes, you know, like the ones at Urbana or the ones at Iowa that are taught on human evolution. And but at the same time, no one's going to say this is the explanation. And because, you know, it's not testable to know that.
Yeah.
But it explains all, to me, in our opinion, it explains a lot of the anatomy that we see that makes the Homo erectus skull distinct from modern humans.
All right. Well, again, we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Russell Shahan. He's professor of anthropology at University of Iowa. The book, if you'd like to read it, which he co-authored, is titled Dragon Bone Hill. It is out there now, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here again to talk with in Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi, let me suggest another explanation for holes in the skulls. The brains of Homo erectus were considered a delicacy, and the reason for those holes in the skull was to get the brain out. I understand that people who live in that area where Homo erectus was found have testified that they still eat monkey brains, and they still open the skulls in that way in order to get the brain out.
Yeah, well, no, this was one of the hypotheses. When Weidenreich, I mentioned Franz Weidenreich as the German anatomist who described many of the fossils, he looked at these fractures on the skull, and he had this idea, especially from looking at the base of the skull. If you turn the skull upside down, the base, that's where the spinal column, you know, would enter, you know, connect up with the brain. That base is broken away on all of these humans. And he hypothesized that they were broken in this characteristic fashion because Homo erectus was a cannibal. It was eating the brains of its fellow individuals. And this idea, of course, was met with a lot of skepticism at the time, but we know that certain early humans did practice cannibalism. There's a famous Neanderthal site. Neanderthals, are, of course, are these that hominid that lived in Europe. And there's one site there, the site of Krapina, that has great evidence that Neanderthals were practicing cannibalism, because there's cut marks on the bone that could only have come from a stone tool. And if you have a stone tool, if you cut the meat away, you leave a very characteristic mark that no carnivore tooth could ever leave. And even on the skulls, we see evidence of those cut marks. However, we don't find cut marks on the ones on Dragon Bone Hill fossils, Homo erectus from Dragon Bone Hill. What we do find is all of the skulls are broken up. So in a sense, they're not really holes in the skull the way that you might think to try to get the brain out. In a sense, we see this as the broken fragmentary nature of the skull was likely a large carnivore doing the breaking. They were also eating the brain, but it wasn't an example of hominid cannibalism there. Remember, too, if Homo erectus was not the primary occupier of the cave, then, in a sense, you would have to argue that, you know, how were they in the cave eating the brains of these of their fellow humans when we know that the hyenas were the primary occupants of the cave.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. And in fact, one of the things that you have in the book is you have some photographs where what you have taken are the fossil skulls of these hyenas and matched them up with the fossil skulls of the Homo erectus and looked at where the hyena's teeth are and where the holes are in the skulls of the Homo erectus, and it looks like they line up pretty well.
Yeah. There are some bite marks. We can differentiate cut marks made by stone tools from bite marks that are made by large carnivores. And some of the bite marks on the Homo erectus skulls from Dragonbone Hill have two small circular holes sort of on either side of the rear part of the skull. And these do match the canines of these big cats or hyenas in some cases. In a sense, we really think that we can't blame this giant hyena for everything. We think that maybe Homo erectus was also preyed on by big cats of the day. There were a number of big lion-sized cats, of course, roaming that part of Asia during the Ice Age.
We have someone else to talk with here. Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. 3 quick questions. One, you said the Chinese ground up the bones used for their medicinal purpose, and, you know, I always sort of had the idea that things you did like that were usually, recently dead, so you're getting some sort of, sort of spiritual thing from the bones, and these are just actually mineral fossils. That seems sort of strange to me. Secondly, some years ago there was a lot of stuff, at least on educational TV, about the muscles arrangement and how you could, appropriately define somebody's face from materials. I was wondering if you can do that. Can you also, in a certain sense, make sure that the face wouldn't look a certain way because the attachments wouldn't be sensible? And 3, the co-authors, Boaz, is that from the family of the Boaz we all know from our education around the turn of the century and the early part of the 20th century? Thank you.
Okay, I can answer those, and those are great questions too. Basically, the first one was about grinding up bone and why, in a sense, what it was used for. Remember, the Chinese, especially many thousands of years ago, thought these bones were from dragons. That's why they called them dragon bones, and so they thought they had medicinal purposes. In actuality, you're right. You can analyze the elements that you could, in a sense, grind up some of the bone and analyze it, and there isn't anything in there except various minerals. And, of course, eating certain minerals, may be a way to ward off certain kinds of illnesses. So you could argue if the caves were fossilized in such a way, the bones were fossilized in such a way, they would have certain minerals in them that might have some medicinal value. But in general, there is no, medicinal value to fossil bone. But the Chinese thought they were dragons, and they thought dragons were spiritual. So it really does all tie in together like that. The second question about reconstruction, we in Dragonbone Hill, in our book, we do provide a reconstruction. It's in the color section, which shows how you could take the skull. In this case, it was Java Man we used because it was a much more complete skull. And you can put the muscles back on, and you build several layers of the muscles, and then you could add skin to it, and you get a very good idea of what this creature would have looked like. And it's a little harder to do it for the Peking Man material because there aren't any faces. Remember I mentioned the hyenas crushing up the skulls? All we have are what's called the skull cap, or there's a technicalism called kalat. So we only have these skull caps, and we don't really have faces. We have just part of the facial bones. So we haven't done that as much, though the Chinese have made reconstructions of Peking Man based on that kind of evidence. But anyway, we do know a lot of what Homo erectus looks like because we have complete fossils, complete skulls from Africa, and a very nearly complete skull from Asia, from Java. Now, the third question about Boaz. I know you're talking about Franz Boaz. And Franz Boaz's name was spelled B-O-A-S. And Noel Boaz, my co-author, spells his name B-O-A-Z. However, as he went through school, you know, various, he went to the University of Virginia, and then, of course, we were students together at Berkeley. Many people always ask him, was he related to Franz Boas? But no, he is not.
Is that did that at all influence his decision to become an anthropologist?
I don't know. Yeah, I'll tell you, he was unusual. He started studying anthropology. He went to this sort of a boys' school up in New England, and he started studying anthropology, you know, when he was like an equivalent of a junior in high school. Most of us did not, you know, have that opportunity. He knew he wanted to be an anthropologist quite early on. So, but I don't think the name was connected.
Yeah, it wasn't connected. All right. Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You have probably already covered this. I came into the show late, but I understood that Peking Man, that term at least, was proven to be a hoax. I'm not sure about that. I've wondered about it since, and I was wondering if you would speak to that, and I'll hang up and let you talk.
Okay. I wonder if the caller is thinking about Piltown Man.
Oh, yes. That's probably what it is. Because Peking Man was not, you know, here again, we have the fossils, and we know there was never any hoax issue with regard to Peking Man. But Piltown Man was found in the U.K., I think, my dates are wrong. I think back in the very early 1900s. And it was basically later discovered to be a composite. And obviously people planted this. They had the jaw was from an ape that the teeth had been ground down. And so they took an ape jaw, ground the teeth down, so they looked more human-like, and because apes have certainly bigger canines and other aspects of their teeth that would give away. And then they had the cranium of a modern human, and yet they buried them in these sediments that were like from the Middle Pleistocene. So they, and at the time, there was a big argument going on in paleoanthropology in Britain that the brain came first in human evolution. And that we basically, in a sense, that the focus or the process that differentiated humans from their ape ancestors was the brain, increase in brain size. And so by planting this fossil that had a very ape-like lower jaw, but a modern human-like cranium, it played right into those arguments of the day. All the paleoanthropologists in the UK accepted this because it all fit their preconceived notions. But at the same time, literally when Piltdown was being discussed, they started to find the first fossils in Africa of Australopithecus. And those forms had modern-like lower jaws, but with very small ape-like brains. And so there was evidence started to accumulate and that Piltdown was just not correct. There was something wrong about it. It was like chimera, maybe, just put together from various pieces. And it was in the 1950s. That a guy named Kenneth Oakley was able to actually look at the bone and using this fluorine test, he looked at the fluorine content in the skull and the fluorine content in the jaw. Now, you would expect, since both of these fossils were found in the same pit, you would expect them to have the same fluorine content. But they didn't. And so that was a dead giveaway. They had come from different locations. We later, no one knows where the jaw was. It was an orangutan jaw. That we know that from studying it later. We don't know where it came from. The skull was actually found, it probably came from someplace in North Africa. And it was a real fossilized modern Homo sapiens skull. But it was not, it was certainly not anything as old as they argued in the early papers about Piltdown Man.
And is there still some question about who really was behind this?
Yes, it goes on and on. There was, the problem is most of the principal parties have died now, so we'll probably never know. But there's been at least six books, I think, written on the Piltdown Man. It's amazing, and about the hoax. And and of course, they each name different people. Most people think it was an amateur who wanted to see the direction of study go one way or the other. And the idea of a scientist planning this is kind of scary, but we don't know who did it. We don't know who perpetrated it. The big issue is why didn't anybody discover it? How could they miss this? And of course, one of the reasons was the fossil was locked up a lot of the time in the British Museum, and people weren't allowed to see it.
And so this was discovered before World War One, and
oh, yeah.
It wasn't until after World War Two, I guess,
exactly.
That it was that someone said, "Wait a minute, there's something wrong with it."
It took more than 50 years to show it was a hoax.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a couple of people we can't take. But if you're interested in the book that we've talked about, you should certainly head down to the bookstore, to the library, and look for it. It's titled Dragon Bone Hill by Noel Boaz and Russell Shahan. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Our guest, Russell Shahan, is professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. If you go looking for his name, spelled C-I-O-C-H-O-N, and there is also that website on the book that I mentioned, which is www.uiowa.edu/dragon. So you can find it that way. And Professor Sean, thanks very much.
Oh, I enjoyed it a lot.
You.
And thanks to your listeners for the calls.
Very good.